Great. Thanks, Carrie. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the IGO, INGO Curative Rights Protection PDP Working Group on the 19th of May at 1600 UTC. On the call today, we have George Kirkos, Jay Chapman, Petter Renforth, Paul Tattersfield, Phil Corwin, Mason Cole, and Ed Swain. We have a tentative apology from Paul Cady. And from staff, we have Mary Wong, Steve Chan, Barry Cobb, and myself, Michelle DeSmiter. I would like to remind you all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you, and over to you.
Thanks, Mary. Petter here. Well, I'm not sure if Phil has managed to log in yet, but let's proceed with updates on if there are any updates on statements of interest. I see only Mary's hands up, but I guess it's not on this topic now. Okay. So, and I'm sorry I couldn't participate in the last meeting, but it's just wanted to note that it's good to have Keith Dretschick on our group as the liaison to council. And then let's proceed to the main topic of today, the discussion with Professor Edward Swain on his report. And welcome, Ed, and it's nice to have you here online, and thanks for a very good work. So I think I plan to turn over to you to make some initial comments. I don't know if Mary or Jay has something special. Okay, Mary.
Thanks, Petter, and thanks, everybody. And I think Jay had his hand up for the comment that he made in the Adobe chat about an update to his SOI. So thanks for letting us know, Jay, and thanks for updating your SOI. Petter, I think what all I wanted to say was that we did have some brief exchanges, as you and Phil know, with Professor Swain, and as you noted, it probably will be best to hand it over to him to deal with the two sets of things that we sent to him. One is obviously the questions that a few working group members had, and another is a set of comments related to the memo, which you see up in the Adobe screen. So, Ed, you probably can't see the Adobe if you're not in it, but we have your final report up now. If you would like at any point for us to stop displaying that and to maybe display the sets of comments and questions, we can do that as well. Just give us a shout. Thank you.
Sure, and I apologize for being out of sync with the platform. I will try to sign in as I'm speaking, and perhaps that will allow me to both participate via this handset and also see what's going on online, but I apologize for being out of sync. So should I give some introductory remarks now, Mary?
No, please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. I very much appreciate the comments and questions on the memo. They show really a terrific amount of engagement with the issue and a great knowledge of some of the issues that I address, and so I really appreciate them. I think that the most one of the things that I wanted to say at the beginning was a recurring theme that I saw in both the questions and the comments concerning let's just say the rhetoric or the framing that was done by the memo, and I think both of them touch upon the same theme. In my view, the memo winds up in a position, based upon my analysis of the legal questions, that's not particularly or strikingly indulgent to the potential position that might be taken by IGOs and indeed may be perceived by them, I think, perhaps unfairly, this is speculative, as hostile. So I think this is more a question of execution or consistency in language than anything. As I understand it, some of the questions just sort of start in a different place. And I think it's an understandable and entirely reasonable place that they're starting. And that's places that the IGOs go through the same dispute resolution procedure as anyone else. They make the same concession to follow on litigation as anyone else. And so this should be uncontroversial. Indeed, any special treatment given them would be unfair, both relative to other UDRP complainants and to the registrants they're opposing in any complaint that the IGOs have initiated. And that might be seen as particularly ungrateful given that the UDRP gives them and everyone else a benefit in addition to the judicial procedures that they are concerned about. And as I said, I think that's a completely legitimate perspective and one that I tried to appreciate in the scope of the memo. The IGO perspective on this is, or may well be, somewhat different. And so I think the memo tries to take that seriously before asking what I hope are good questions of that position. The premise of IGOs is that they're peculiarly vulnerable in judicial proceedings because of the number of jurisdictions to which they're exposed. And because wherever they are, they have no one that is necessarily in their corner. They're neither the home state nor its citizens, and they can't steal the march by initiating suit or choosing a jurisdiction in which they're the home team because they have no particular home team. And the result of this is that they are often asserting immunity in circumstances that have apparently unfair consequences. Either for employees or for Haitians who are subject to cholera or what have you. So one could react to that and basically say, well, here immunity has been waived, end of story. But I think the IGO perspective might be that they are they should be given special treatment of some kind in order to reflect their immunity. And this claim to special treatment is not uncommon, and it's not unusual to maintain it, even if you are being given a privilege. So if the District of Columbia, where I'm now calling from, said you have to follow this administrative process, IGO, in order to maintain the street, but only if you sign this piece of paper waiving your immunity, IGOs would be concerned. And so their perspective, I think, might be that however apparent the symmetry might seem to be, they're being asked to give up something, namely immunity from suit, that others never had to give up. And so the others are giving up just their rights to contest venue, but not their rights to contest the availability of a judicial proceeding at all. So what the memo tries to do is ask first, well, how robust is that immunity that they're really giving up? And only then can we really assess whether this is a big sacrifice. Once we establish that the scope of that immunity is not altogether clear, I think that shapes the perspective on waiver and all the alternatives. So I think I understand the contrary starting place, and I want to review the memo to make sure that there isn't excess indulgence through poor choice of words or something like that of the contrary perspective. But I think it's fair to express the contrary position as forcefully as someone else might in order to fully evaluate it. So I just want to sort of say I understand where the comments about tone are coming from. I think there's a reason why that tone is there, but I want to make sure that it doesn't go into excess. And so I will gratefully accept these comments and look over it in that regard.
Okay, thanks. Do you have any other specific comments, Mel, from or replies to all notes?
I can respond to a number of different questions, but I don't want to exhaust people's patience. So would you prefer that I go down the questions that were mentioned and sort of provide my reaction?
I presume that you're still not online, but I see no hands up. I see only a question from George Kirkos that I suppose the IGOs didn't submit any comments to us today. And as Mary replied, no, we have not received anything. Phil, your hands up.
Yes, thank you, Peter, and thank you, Professor Swain, for the excellent document and for participating in this call today. There are two main points I wanted to explore with you. One is that kind of the Mobius strip here that we seem to be on is that you do a very good job of considering the different analyses for the views of, and you make clear that different jurisdictions view the IGO immunity differently. Some accorded absolute immunity, some functional, some restrictive. But ultimately, for this particular, since there's no case law on this subject, we get to a situation where the only way to be certain of what there's certainly no absolute global rule that's a clear black and white consensus. So it becomes a matter of would the IGO be viewed as having immunity for this particular purpose in this jurisdiction, and you wind up with a situation where the only way to be sure whether or not the IGO would be able to successfully assert immunity in the UDRP waiver situation and saying this was coerced and shouldn't be binding because it trespassed our rights would be to actually go into the court and get a determination. So you get this conundrum where the only way to be sure of what the treatment is in a particular jurisdiction and whether an IGO shouldn't be pulled into court is to go into court and ask them the question of what immunity does the IGO have. Is that a fairly correct interpretation of the situation, given that there's no global rule on this?
There is some uncertainty that's going to plague this, but I think the perspective of the memo is to say that if the status quo is maintained, in which the IGOs continue to sign or participate by initiating the UDRP proceeding, they continue to make this waiver of their immunity, that largely moots the question of whatever immunity they would otherwise assert. And so what the memo is basically saying in the perhaps overlong initial parts is that in the absence of such a waiver, there would be a variety of answers one might get concerning their immunity, particularly in this commercial or quasi-commercial setting. You might get a different set of answers depending upon what the IGO is and what the jurisdiction is. This is largely resolved, however, by the waiver, which they effect by initiating a UDRP proceeding. So my understanding of the state of play is, though, that they are objecting to the continued presence of that waiver, that they would like their concession to be less, or they would like to maintain their immunity by constructing some alternate procedure altogether. And so that would make it, the only way to evaluate that is to say, what immunity are they otherwise entitled to?
Right. But the only way to know what, there's no principle, there's no legal rule which says they are entitled to absolute immunity for purposes of the UDRP in any jurisdiction in the world. It comes down to how would each individual jurisdiction answer that question? Am I correct in that?
Yes, that's right, except that I think that the waiver, in the status quo, the waiver is fairly clarifying in that regard. It is possible, I suppose, that, and this, you alluded to this in your question, it's possible, I suppose, that a particular jurisdiction might say that IGOs are given absolute immunity within our jurisdiction. They appear to have waived in this circumstance, and that was inappropriate and amounted to a compelled waiver. I don't think that that argument, though, is especially strong, and this is something that I mentioned a couple times in the memo and perhaps can make sure is adequately highlighted, because the reason why I think that argument about compelled waiver isn't especially strong is, to my understanding, there's nothing that really compels an IGO to initiate a UDRP versus just avoiding the whole process and starting a lawsuit somewhere, or, for that matter, tolerating the continued compromise of whatever trademark-related rights they have. And so I think the argument that an IGO might make that we are entitled to continued immunity because we haven't genuinely waived this, I think that argument is not terribly persuasive.
Right. And not wanting to monopolize this, but just to close the loop on this, you do observe in one point in the memo that, I'm quoting here, assuming a national court would find that the mutual consent commitment effectuates a waiver of IGO immunity, the issue confronting ICANN, which, of course, is the issue we're confronting in this working group, is a policy question infused with legal principles. So parsing that hypothetical, IGO files a UDRP, wins the UDRP, the registrant files in a court of mutual jurisdiction for de novo court review. IGO, and let's take two different cases. In one, in both the IGO comes in and with a defense saying, we can't be hauled into court, we have sovereign immunity. One court says, well, that's true, in our nation you have absolute jurisdiction, and we're going to dismiss the lawsuit because you can't be pulled into our courts. So that's the end of the story, although it did take at least a court appearance to get the acknowledgement that they're not liable to that jurisdiction. In another jurisdiction, they're pulled in, the court says, in this type of trademark commercial transaction where you're getting a benefit in terms of a faster and less expensive process, we have no problem with the waiver of the immunity. The point I took away from that is that for this working group, we're not dealing with any universally recognized global prohibition on asking IGOs to waive their immunity for the very small possibility of being pulled into an appeal from a UDRP decision, that we're really confronted with a policy decision in which we have discretion rather than a strict legal rule where we say, well, the recognized global rule is that they have immunity, therefore we should get rid of the waiver. For IGOs.
Yes, I think that that's right. And the way you put it is, I think, the right way of thinking about it. Is there anything that is legally violative in asking a body that has immunity but has the capability of waiving that immunity? Is there anything wrong with asking it to waive that immunity? And I think the answer to that generally is no. One can imagine circumstances in which simply to frame the question is unfair because you're compelling them to say yes. But I don't think we have that circumstance here. And so regardless of the nature of the underlying immunity to which the IGO would be entitled in the mutual jurisdiction state, if it has said, no, we want to start this UDRP process, and we accept that as a consequence, we will be vulnerable to judicial jurisdiction in a follow-on proceeding, that's okay. And so it's, in my view, a policy question as to whether you want to recognize the differentiated circumstances of an IGO by giving it a somewhat different deal, or whether you want to say no, by beginning the UDRP, you are basically asking to be treated like any other party that would object to a registration.
Okay. Sorry, Patrick here, just a follow-up question there. And now I'm talking generally. Is it possible for an IGO to waive their immunity in a first step, and then, depending on how the case goes on, take back their immunity during the case? Or if it's the same case and they have waived their immunity, it will be waived until the final decision. Is there any general policy or practice on that issue?
I mean, this is one of those many situations, and I don't want to be ducking the question too often by saying the law varies, but as a general matter, if you open the barn door by participating in a judicial proceeding, you have waived your immunity. And likewise, if you have in a contractual document said we are subjecting ourselves to the jurisdiction of the court, you're not usually able to, change your mind once you see the proceedings are going against you. I do want to be clear. There are a couple of different forms of waiver that the memo discusses. In one set, some IGOs, particularly international financial institutions, have in their governing instruments waived in advance their immunity so as to enable their participation in certain kinds of transactions. But that's only a limited class of IGOs. The other ones generally are regarded as having the capacity to waive if the circumstances are to their liking. And so that's what we're really concerned with here. And if they've done that by the UDRP concession, that's fine. The third kind of waiver is if they initiate suit themselves, avail themselves of the jurisdiction, they are not able to say, well, we just want to be the plaintiff, we don't want to be the defendant. Or if they are just sued and they show up and they start participating and after a while decide they don't like the way the judge is looking at them, again, they can't change their mind halfway.
Okay, thanks. That was reply to my question. And as I said, I think it's important that also Phil points out that we will get the general practice and legislations. There are some local differences in everything.
Right.
Okay, I see now. Yes, George.
Hi, George Gregos for the transcript. First, I'd like to thank the professor for doing a very good job on the memo. My comments might have seemed a little bit harsh, but I know that he did a lot of work because I read all the footnotes and I saw that he did go through our mailing list in quite a great deal of detail. I had obviously my written questions that are on the screen, but just generally, I was curious about the scenario in the U.S. State Department's letter where they said that, you know, they fulfilled their Article 6 TER obligations simply by allowing the lawsuit of an IGO to be able to be, you know, initiated. Is that his understanding of other jurisdictions around the world, or would it? Is that the only knowledge that we have, the U.S. State Department? And my second question would be to the issue of immunity as a defense versus kind of like an offense. I give the example, I don't know if it's on the written memo or if we talked about it last week, of let's suppose somebody, you know, forget about domain names, if we have somebody selling World Bank cookies or UNESCO cookies and the World Bank or UNESCO wanted to do something about it, can they use that immunity to somehow drag that trademark infringer into some international tribunal, or is that something that they have a power to do, or is it, you know, just a defense mechanism if they were, you know, to be, you know, sued by somebody else? So if you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Of course. And thank you, by the way, for your written comments. I thought they were very acute and quite helpful. As to taking your questions in reverse order, I understood from the memo the cookie scenario to be pressing on something that I wanted to be clear on in the memo and perhaps wasn't sufficiently. You were asking about the oddity of the fact that we are envisioning here the possibility of an arbitration alternative when there's not a contractual relationship between the parties. Is that consistent with the question that you're now framing?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And the point I wanted to be making in the memo, and I'm going to review to make sure I make it successfully, is exactly this, that the exactly one that I think your question is pushing on. We see the arbitration mechanism being successfully used by IGOs when they are in a one-to-one, you know, privity of contract with an employee or a supplier or someone else, and the parties sit down and agree, well, instead of going through this, having any disputes that arise being heard by court, let's have it heard by this arbitration process. Is that okay? The parties both sign on that. What I'm trying to highlight here, and this touches on another question that was posed in the written comments, I'm trying to say that doesn't fit very well this scenario where the domain name registrant has never acquiesced in the creation of an arbitration mechanism unless ICANN starts making them acquiesce in that way. And it's also unusual in that usually no third party like ICANN is necessary to facilitate that arrangement. Again, in the normal course, what happens is the IGO and its counterparty just agree on the arbitration mechanism. Here, as I understand it, the IGOs may be considering asking ICANN to impose this as an alternative on domain name registrants. And what I want to get across in the memo, and I'll have to make sure that I do so successfully, is that this is unusual. And so the arbitration alternative on which they frequently rely quite successfully doesn't fit too neatly in this box. Please interrupt me if that is not an adequate answer.
Phil?
Phil Corwin here, Professor. Just trying to parse it. When a domain registrant registers a domain, they do that through they establish a contract with an accredited registrar, but that contract is always required to have a provision in which the registrant agrees to be subject in a case where the domain is alleged to be infringing trademark in a certain way to be subject to the UDRP process, which is, whether you call it an arbitration or not, it's an alternative dispute resolution process that they agree to be subject to. Does that change the analysis at all, or is it consistent with what you just said?
Well, so, I mean, I could imagine a world in which the ICANN tries to fully simulate the arbitration alternative by saying for like a domain name registrant, you are agreeing to not only this initial UDRP alternative, but also as a backstop to that, something like UNCITRAL arbitration in order to review the merits of the UDRP proceeding, like you presently have it set up so domestic courts can review the adequacy of the inquiry. Admittedly, they changed the inquiry somewhat, but it's approximately a review mechanism. So I could see you could create something like that. But again, that's still somewhat different because ICANN is saying you only get the privilege of registration if you do this. That's different than a simple bilateral contractual arrangement.
Right. And just to take it one step further, we're not talking here about the possibility of changing that standard registrar contract where the registrant says, well, if an IGO brings an action against you, it won't be heard by a UDRP provider, it'll be heard by UNCITRAL. What we're saying here is that if an IGO brings a UDRP against you and there's an appeal, the appeal will be to UNCITRAL or some other designated arbitration group, and you hereby agree to forfeit your right of judicial redress, which is a whole different deal, and a lot, as we know, many national courts wouldn't enforce such a provision.
Well, it's kind of a matter of speculation as to whether they would enforce it, but I agree with you that is a different question. One of the other questions that you posed, I think it was George Kirikos posed it, is, isn't there an inconsistency in principle between an IGO opposing the mutual jurisdiction aspect of the UDRP process and not opposing it in terms of the registration concession? And there may or may not be such an inconsistency. I can't really speak to why they would oppose it in one context and not the other. That's a question I perhaps better posed to them than to me, but somewhat similar, but not precisely similar issues are raised. As to the question about the State Department comments, I don't want to lose sight of that entirely. So that's an unusual situation because the U.S. has basically said we are being consistent with the Paris Convention by opening up these proceedings in principle to the relevant parties without changing our laws to reflect the different ways that they might perfect their trademark interests. And so the answer from the State Department, as I understand it, is largely, we've done enough if we have opened up the opportunity for initiating suit. Beyond that, you're sort of on your own. You have to maintain your own proceedings and, good luck. That is, I think, less indulgent than some other jurisdictions have been. It raised the question, and I think this, I don't remember where precisely in the comments this was, so apologies if I'm misattributing it, but one of you raised the question, well, doesn't that same principle suggest that attorney generals, say, in the same country as the domain name registrant might bring a UDRP action on behalf of the IGO and thereby meet its obligation? To which my answer, as to whether that's a viable alternative, my answer is, I guess that it would be better than nothing from the IGO perspective, but that an IGO would probably not regard that as appropriate as an exclusive recourse because one of the principles of their immunity is that they don't want to be dependent upon a particular state for espousal or protection, and they're likely to be especially skeptical, I would think, of whether the home state of a domain name registrant is likely to be an effective representative of their interests. And so, to me, it's probably, though it's a very complicated scenario, it's probably more appealing to imagine them assigning their right to proceed in the UDRP to some private party, a law firm or some other agency, than it is to depend upon the intervention by a state government. I don't know if that answered the question.
I take the side of it. It was a perfect reply.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
I said I think the silence said it was perfectly replied to the question.
Great, thank you. You know, there were a number of other questions that were posed, and some of them involved alternate sort of factual complications or scenarios. And I guess the question, and I can discuss this with Mary and others if they want, there are other scenarios in which we could imagine immunity type issues arising other than the principal scenario that we envision, that I discussed, in which the IGO is initiating the UDRP and then winning is subject to a suit as a defendant in a national court. There are other scenarios I suppose address, but it will depend upon your evaluation of how likely those scenarios are and whether they're something that the working group is particularly concerned about.
Well, Peter here. I think the report as such is pretty good covered, and as we say, we also discuss very few, if any, cases yearly. So it seems that we have pretty good summary and covering in the report as is, but of course we can discuss it quickly in between from now and the next meeting also. I see no one that have any other view on that. Bill?
I have just one last thing I'd like to explore for just a moment, and then we can let the professor go. In the paper, in its discussion of the different forms of immunity, absolute, which of course is absolute, if you're an IGO, you can't be brought into court. Period, functional, which says, well, if you're asserting it in regard to something that's similar to a sovereign immunity power, you're okay, but if it's more commercial in nature, it doesn't get immunity. And then the functional, where you have to show that it's essential to your function. You got into, there were some statements that certainly under restrictive immunity, that bring a UDRP, which is basically a trademark dispute, trademarks being essentially commercial in character, wouldn't be entitled to immunity, whereas under the restrictive, whereas in functional, it's more arguable that in defending its name, it might be entitled to immunity. Is that a correct interpretation, and do you come down one way or the other as to how it should be viewed, or is it strictly a matter of which jurisdiction you're in and which rule they choose to apply and how they choose to apply it?
You know, as to the basic question, I think there is potentially daylight between the scope of immunity under a restrictive approach that makes a distinction between commercial and non-commercial and this functional approach. And so there are circumstances in which it may be part of the function of the IGO to preserve its the character of its mark interests against commercial encroachment, for example. So there is potentially that. It's very hard for me to say, you know, concretely too much about this because of the state of the law on the question. There are some cases that are discussed in the memo concerning the scope of functional immunity, because that's, I think, a more common approach outside the United States. And those are a little hard to predict, to be honest with you. They engage in some interesting line drawing concerning what is within the function of the organization and what isn't. By and large, restrictive and commercial should overlap. When an IGO is doing something that's commercial in character, that's likely to be outside of its proper function as well. But I can see some possible distinctions between the two. And if an IGO is essentially saying, all we're doing here, folks, is defending the distinctiveness of our mark against attempts to exploit it, so that people interested in what we do and our activities as an organization can come to a website and find out about them, that's an argument that has some appeal under a functional approach.
Okay. And I know I said that would be – thank you for that. And one last inquiry, which is that ICANN is headquartered in the U.S. It's a California nonprofit corporation subject to U.S. law. The UDRP exists as an ICANN consensus policy, but it's imposed on registrants as a contractual matter, as a contractual requirement. Does the fact that ICANN's headquartered in the U.S. And that the U.S. has not ratified the Convention on Privileges and Immunities of the Specialized Agencies, but has a different legislative approach that adopts the restrictive immunity view, should that have any bearing on our consideration toward a bias toward the U.S. view, or should we be more open to alternative points of view?
I view that as largely a question for you rather than for me, but I don't see that the position of ICANN as a California nonprofit and the entailments of what conventions the U.S. is a party to or not, I don't see why that necessarily should change your perspective. The claims of immunity are really ones that are germane to U.S. courts and not so much to private entities, nonprofit or otherwise, in the that operate in the United States. And so I view the question, and this is just my instinct. My instinct is the question for you is, what is a sound policy that respects the various interests of the parties concerned, both the IGO's interest in preserving their immunity and the interest of everyone else in a level playing field and a fair procedure. And that's informed by the international law of immunity, but not solely or not especially tilted towards the United States, except as a predictive matter that that's where suits are likely to arise.
Okay. Thank you, and that was my last question. I think George has his hand up for a follow-up.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I saw Mary was first. But
Mary, too. Oh, Mary's gone.
Okay. George, go ahead.
George Grigos here for the transcript. From looking at things at 40,000 feet, we probably can just stay with the status quo. That seems to be where the memo is leading us. But I just wanted to, as a kind of devil's advocate kind of argument, say, if we were to change the UDRP, which I don't think we have to, pragmatically, what are the benefits that the IGO receives at, say, Unitrol versus the court? Like, would it be because in a court, you would obviously hope that the Unitrol would deliver the same verdict, that there wouldn't be some advantage to going to Unitrol. Like, what are the advantages? Is it just the freedom from producing certain discovery of documents, or like what exactly is it buying besides having the jurisdiction of that court? Because you could still go to the arbitration and say Canadian law would apply if it was a Canadian registrant, and you would think that Canadian courts would be the best place to decide that, because Canadian judges would obviously be more familiar with the Canadian law than some UN arbitrator from Switzerland or Africa. I guess what I wanted to say is, if there's a certain benefit that the IGO derives from having that access to the arbitration panel relative to the courts, is there a way to say, okay, the registrant can still take it to a Canadian court, but they'd have to give up something? Like, let's say that the benefit was, you know, the IGO wouldn't have to pay damages or something if they lost. Could we say the registrant can still take it to the court, but the IGO has, you know, immunity from, you know, cost damages or something like that? I don't know if the professors understood my question, but that's, I guess, what I'm trying to say, think about.
It's a very interesting question. So I don't lose sight of it, as to the last part, if I were the IGO making that trade-off and saying, yes, we agree to follow-on review in Canadian court, but here's the way in which the Canadian court has to tie its hands. It can't order discovery, or it can't provide damages or something like that. I would be a little cautious if I were advising the IGO as to whether all those compromises would be enforceable within a Canadian court, which is not likely to view kindly attempts to constrain the operation of its normal proceedings. I'd be much more comfortable if I were the IGO in either saying we're all in or we are excluded from the court proceedings altogether. It seems to me that's the clearer and more determinate option. As to your initial question, what are they getting preferring that the matter be diverted? That's a complex question. They are certainly not going to go through the same discovery process. They would, I think, on the whole, say that the merits of the question would be treated just as well as they would in the court, but without some of the compromises of procedure that the judicial proceeding might conceivably require of them. It's harder to test the comparison, because here what we have is, in theory anyway, the resolution of a trademark-related dispute that is quasi-private, quasi-public in character, and not an ordinary kind of breach of contract suit. And so it's a little hard to test whether the relative appeals of these two mechanisms would be the same in this context as against another one. Critics say that the arbitration proceedings that the IGOs tend to favor are expensive, throw up barriers to legal representation, and are just more difficult to commence and conclude. IGOs say, on the other hand, that they are perfectly adequate. I just don't know whether that follows very well in this setting.
But you don't think then that if we were going to draft the UDRP, that making, you know, certain concessions to address the vulnerabilities that IGOs are concerned about would be it would probably be a dead end if we tried to go that approach?
Well, it's an interesting question, and one that I hadn't really given much thought to. I just would have that my initial reaction is, if I were an IGO, I would be skeptical that this would be that the constraints that such a document tried to impose on, say, a Canadian court would be fully enforceable. There might be a tendency on the part of the court to say, in for a penny, in for a pound, you have waived your immunity to the proceeding, and we will decide what is appropriate procedure. Thank you very much. So I'd be a little wary of that. That's at least my seat-of-the-pants reaction.
Okay. And just to frame it the other way, from the protecting the domain registrant who wants to go to court, if one was going to say, okay, you can go to UNIC trial or arbitration, but there would be discovery, or there would be costs, or there would be things that you would get in a Canadian court or U.S. court, that would be stuff that I guess the IGOs would persist about because it would expose their vulnerability, like the stuff that they're trying to avoid. Is that your understanding?
Maybe, but I would be more confident were I they that those sorts of concessions that would be made would be enforceable, because arbitration is a little bit more inclined to just follow the scope of the contract, in effect, or the scope of the jurisdictional grant. And so I mentioned, I think, in the memo the possibility that, well, if you are really advocating an arbitral alternative, maybe you pick up the costs. Now that may not be politically feasible. They may not view that as a welcome option, but it might be one way of sort of splitting the baby.
I think from a registrant's point of view, though, that the costs would not be a sufficient safeguard, because who cares about cost if, you know, you've lost the ability to fully defend the asset? Because some of these domain names are worth, you know, many millions of dollars. And if I was a registrant, I would want the protection of my courts where I could make all the appropriate legal arguments, have discovery, have, you know, the ability to cross-examine witnesses. If you give that up, then, you know, it's really, you know, a whole different, you know, it's not a level playing field from the domain registrant's point of view. And so trying to balance those out, I think it's, you know, a very tough policy question. And the way the UDRP was designed in the first place back in the 1990s was that, okay, we have this policy, but in the end it can go to the courts. So the policy isn't really binding on anybody unless they actually, you know, decide that it's binding by not appealing. And so it'd be a big policy change to start making it binding, because you could get that deviation from the court system that people are worried about, that you have a panel deciding one thing, whereas the courts would decide something totally different, and there wouldn't be those checks and balances.
Yes, I think that's a fair point. You know, the other thing that's really unresolved at this point, at least in my understanding of the case law, is, and I think it's a subject of legitimate concern for IGOs, is that their ability, the scope of the rights that they might defend in a national court proceeding is not necessarily the same as the scope of the rights that they might protect in the UDRP. And so this is sort of the Barcelona problem that we've encountered in the United States. So I think that may be behind some of the concerns they have about judicial proceedings, is that the whatever they would be able to actually invoke as a legitimate interest favoring the cancellation of a registration in a domestic proceeding may not be as broad as that which they successfully invoked in the UDRP.
So, George Kirkus, again, so you'd be saying then that there'd be a forum shopping issue if we change the UDRP, that the IGOs demanding that binding arbitration wouldn't, in effect, be saying we expect to get a different result through that procedure than we would through the courts, so we're going to take that route.
That is one possible implication. The other implication, though, is that in the status quo, the IGO may think we are being drawn into a jurisdiction that is primarily the result of the choice of the registrant, and the registrant may have the ability to tilt that, to basically limit the forum shopping unduly by choosing a jurisdiction which IGO rights are less broad than either Paris or the UDRP would suggest.
Okay, thanks a lot, Professor Swain, for a very interesting discussion, further information today.
Of course.
Petter?
Yep.
It's Jim Bykoff. I'm not on the link. I'm on the audio. Could I just raise one thing?
Yes, please.
I wanted to thank Professor Swain for his opinion, and I just wanted to raise a point about a recent decision that came down May 10th from the U.S. District Court, Central District of California. It doesn't talk about IGOs, but it talks about Native American tribal immunity, and it interprets the UDRP policy and the court proceeding that followed, and tries to, I think it takes the position that the UDRP, you know, when the tribe was involved in the UDRP, that it waived its immunity. And then in the court action that the unsuccessful party brought, that the claims that related to the UDRP, there was also a waiver, but on other claims that went beyond the UDRP jurisdiction, they still could or may have not waived their immunity. It may be good to take a look at that opinion, just because there's a lot of content on interpretation of UDRP and court decisions with immunity.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you very much. And that's May 12th, Central District of California?
It's actually, the decision came down May 10th. I don't have the site, but you can find it. I found it on Pacer. It's Virtual Point Incorporated versus Porsche Band of Creek Indians.
Okay. We'll look at that. Thank you.
Okay.
Jim, can you send it to the mailing list?
Sure.
I've noticed that you don't have the case, but at least
I have
the information so that we can identify it and find it, because it was very interesting.
I have the it's a 12-page decision. I have the decision.
Oh, perfect.
Great.
Perfect. Okay. So thanks again, Professor Swain, for all the work you've done for us, and also for participating in this follow-up question session. It has been very interesting and good to have these replies and discussions.
I've
seen one
here.
From the list. When will we get the final memo?
Yes.
I'm sorry, this is a question to me?
Yes.
I will be. Why don't I follow up on that? My timing over the next week is extremely bad, but after that it clears.
Okay, good. Because that's also give us a week to cooperate and see what further questions and revisions that's comes up from after this discussion today.
Okay.
Peter, Phil
here. That's a useful time. Yep.
I just want to add, for the professor, again, thanking him and looking forward to the final memo, which takes the input and the discussions into consideration. We would certainly hope to have the final one, and it sounds quite possible, before we meet and at the ICANN meeting in Helsinki, Finland, which is the final week of June. So if we can get it by mid-June, that will give everyone on the working group time to digest it and be and have it for discussion purposes in Helsinki.
Super. Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And then we have slowly slipped over to last point of the agenda. Next steps, and I saw Mary noted that our working group meeting is scheduled on June 27 for Helsinki. Is there any other notes on that meeting, Mary? Possibilities to meet with other groups also to discuss the topics? Especially if we can have updates from GAC, if there is any, or ideas. Mary?
Hi, Peter. I'm just looking at the schedule now. I think one benefit of the Helsinki format is that the board and other SOs and ACs are supposed to be free to comment or participate in work of the other groups, which of course include GNSO PDPs like ours. The GAC does have a fairly full schedule, but looking at what we're scheduled against in Helsinki, which, as I noted in the chat, is the afternoon of the first day, the 27th of June, like I said, the board is supposed to be free, so we might want to reach out to interested board members. The GAC has a session on country and territory names, and I think on the effectiveness of GAC advice. So I'm not sure how many people from the GAC we might get, but it may also be worth reaching out to the IGOs, many of whom are observers to the GAC and who may not be as interested in some of the topics on the GAC agenda that's scheduled across some hours. So we can reach out to all of these folks that I mentioned on the working group's behalf if you would like. Obviously, then we would need to plan an agenda for that working group meeting that allows for the sort of maximum interaction that we would hope to have by having these additional participants present. I hope that helps, Peter.
Thanks. And I was just asking also that George said in the chat line here, do you know which members, countries of the GAC have the ear of the IGOs? There is a group within GAC that deals with this specific topic, and I think they also have connections directly with IGOs. So is it possible to reach out to this group and these GAC members specifically to see if they can participate and we can have a follow-up with them? And I also see Phil's hands up.
Oh, thank you, Peter. Phil here. I just want to make in terms of next meeting, I just want to clarify that we haven't discussed it, but I would think that if we receive the final memo prior to the Helsinki meeting, we may want to hold another call of this group before Helsinki to discuss that before we start traveling. So I know there's certainly no meeting next week because of Inta and because there's no final memo from the professor, but if we get something in early June, I think we should just probably keep open the possibility of having another call before we meet in Helsinki.
Thanks. Yes, and thanks, Mary. I see your reply to my question on the chat that you can certainly reach out to our contacts for the IGO GAC small group, and it may be just as important to have board members participate in our Helsinki session, frankly. And I think that's a good idea, very good. As you may remember, we had a long time ago a small breakfast meeting with these GAC members that deals with this specific issue. And although nothing happened after that, but that specific meeting was quite good and interesting, and also gave us, both parties, frank and direct input from our topics. So if we can have those representatives up again, and especially now when we have the Professor Swain's report. I will not hold your time too much, but just to follow up and to summarize, if we can by next week. Oh yes, we have. Many of us have something, other things to do during the next week, but I think if we can summarize the meeting today and see what's necessary to amend and add into Professor Swain's report, and if I remember it correctly, he could make a final draft within 2 or at least 3 weeks from now. So then we will have an extra working group meeting before Helsinki. I think that's a working plan that we can arrange. Yes, if Professor Swain gets out his final memo by mid-June, we can shoot for a pre-Helsinki working meeting on June 23. Okay, good. I was just saying that I see no more comments or hands up, but George just said, great work, everyone. Have a nice day, and the same to you all. Thanks for today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, bye.
Thank you all. Today's meeting has been adjourned. Operator, please stop the recordings and disconnect all remaining lines. Have a great day, everyone.